Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity International University. I'm Matthew Epinette, Executive Director of the Center. This episode of the podcast features my talk from this summer's 30th annual summer conference. In the address, I make a few comments on the history of bioethics over the past 30 years before spending the bulk of the time talking about the present state of bioethics and what bioethics might look like in the coming years. Before we get to the lecture, though, I'd like to ask you a question. Are you a CBHD member? If so, thank you. But if not, you can join today. By becoming a member of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, you gain access to content from the Center that cannot be found anywhere else. Members receive a print subscription to Ethics in Medicine and International Journal of Bioethics, access to past CBHD conference audio and video through our web portal on cbhd.org, discounts at prominent publishers such as the University of Chicago Press and InterVarsity Press, discounts on prominent journals such as the American Journal of Bioethics, book discussion groups available only to CBHD members, members-only email newsletter with more in-depth content from CBHD, and more. It's worth noting, too, that next week we'll be sending out an email to all our members announcing the next book discussion title, as well as a few other pieces of member-specific info. Membership is only $75 per year, or for students, $40 a year, or $5 a month. Join today at cbhd.org/signup. That's cbhd.org/sign-up. And now my plenary address from this year's 30th annual conference. The lecture's entitled Bioethics Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow.
The issues of bioethics all address the question of how we treat human beings in the specific context of the frailties of human life in the aftermath of the fall. When thinking about the Christian stake in bioethics, perhaps there's no more important thread that runs through bioethics yesterday, today, and tomorrow than this. The issues of bioethics all address the question of how we treat human beings in the specific context of the frailties of human life in the aftermath of the fall. This comes from Nigel Cameron's chapter, The Christian Stake in Bioethics, The State of the Question, which is a revised version of his talk, the very first plenary at the very first conference here at CBHD. In this talk, the very last talk of the 30th conference, I'll make only a few comments about bioethics yesterday, given the excellent coverage on bioethics over the course of the weekend. So I'll spend most of my time talking about bioethics today and bioethics tomorrow, which are, as we might expect, closely intertwined. As I was reviewing the videos to assemble the video package that we watched yesterday, it was interesting how many times someone said something along the lines of, "No one is talking about these bioethics issues from a specifically Christian point of view." The precise wording varied, of course, but this was the sentiment oft repeated, particularly in those first two or three conferences. No one is talking about the issues of bioethics from a specifically Christian point of view. And so those first few conferences in particular sought to set forth what the discipline of bioethics was or was becoming, and the ways in which Christian faith might affect both the enduring and emerging questions of how we treat human beings in the specific context of the frailties of human life in the aftermath of the fall. And pursuing answers to these questions has been the work of the Center for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, as well as the bioethics degree and certificate programs here at Trinity for these many years now. The challenges raised in the early years of this conference include, as has been pointed out, the lack of explicitly Christian engagement in the area of bioethics. End-of-life issues, particularly the potential for legalized suicide, assisted suicide, and of course that happened in Oregon in November of 94, although it didn't go into effect until 97 because of court challenges. Coming capabilities in the arena of genetics, which was top of mind given the launch of the Human Genome Project in 1990. Managed care, reproductive technologies were also addressed in those first few years, as were ideas and strategies towards informing the public, shaping public opinion, and addressing bioethical issues through public policy. And these topics have been visited multiple times, along with other topics, over the span of these 30 conferences. And please, if you haven't had a chance yet, please do look at the all of the artwork from all of the conferences. It's interesting, as we shall see, how these topics of those first handful of conferences and extensions of those issues continue to resurface and perhaps even increase in importance in the field of bioethics. Perhaps you participated in the poll that we ran over the last couple of weeks asking, what is the most significant development in bioethics in the past 30 years? We offered these four options: the cloning of Dolly the sheep, the legalization of assisted suicide, the Human Genome Project, CRISPR gene editing, and we left space for other. Thank you to everyone who participated in the survey. There are, of course, other significant events we might have added to this list. I think of Terry Schiavo's case and death in 2005, the Supreme Court's ruling in 2013 that Myriad could not patent the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Also in 2013, the launch of the US Brain Initiative and the EU Human Brain Project, the birth of gene-edited babies in 2018 in China, the COVID-19 pandemic, and others. The survey results show that Dolly the sheep came in at 7%, the legalization of assisted suicide at 24%, the Human Genome Project at 21%, CRISPR at 30%, and other at 18%. Among the other things were reproductive technologies, brain-computer interfaces, the increased emphasis on autonomy, artificial intelligence, the rise in prominence of the transgender debates, the coalescing of bioethics into a discipline, and that actually got 2 votes, and the Dobbs decision overturning Roe, which also got 2 votes, which it's worth noting occurred 1 year ago today, which NPR will not let you forget if you turned it on this weekend. Interesting results, surprising, not surprising? I don't know. I'll leave it to you to decide. But thank you again for participating in the poll. Much more could be said about yesterday, but let's move on. Our most recent media requests at the center give a window, a starting place perhaps, to begin thinking about where bioethics stands today, and perhaps even a glimmer of where it's going tomorrow. Recent requests have included proposed changes to the 14-day rule. How should we think about artificial wombs? What are we to make of 3-parent embryos? The expansion of assisted suicide in the US and of both assisted suicide and euthanasia around the world. And that was one interview, by the way, the 3-parent embryos and the assisted suicide, which was interesting. One reporter working on two stories, but one interview. Convenient for me, I suppose. And the ethics of brain-computer interfaces, like the ones that Elon Musk's Neuralink or Google DeepMind are developing. These are all important issues and a snapshot, certainly, of where we are, of the state of media attention, and of public interest. But there are other issues that somehow escape the media's attention. One of the topics covered early on at one of the conferences was managed care, which was, in many ways, related to the costs of healthcare. While the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which we probably all refer to as Obamacare, was passed in 2010 and it did make some changes and opened up some new avenues for folks to be insured and to gain more access to healthcare, there remain inequities, severe inequities in parts of the US healthcare system and in healthcare around the world. And one effect of these inequities and one effect of the cost of healthcare is that many Americans are forced into debt, sometimes deep debt, over medical costs. Just a couple of weeks ago, Human Rights Watch released a report calling for stronger protections for Americans regarding aggressive billing and debt collection especially by not-for-profit hospitals. According to a project by KFF Health News and NPR, nationwide, about 100 million people are in some form of healthcare debt. That's about 41% of all adults have some form of healthcare debt. Christianity Today reported a few years ago that in response to this situation, more than a dozen congregations are partnering with a debt forgiveness organization to cancel millions in medical debt for their communities. A few examples. Pathway Church in Wichita, Kansas spent $22,000 of its budget, which was partly meant for publicizing their Easter services, to eliminate $2.2 million in medical debt. So $22,000 eliminated $2.2 million. Emmanuel Memorial Episcopal Church in Champaign, Illinois used $15,000 of a surplus from a building project to eliminate $4 million in debt for 3,000 families. Revolution Annapolis, a small church in Maryland that doesn't even have a building, collected $15,000 one December, wiped out $1.9 million in debt. City Church in Evansville, Indiana raised $15,000 and eliminated $4 million in debt. The Christian stake in bioethics, indeed. According to a 2018 study by the Center to Advance Palliative Care, the prevalence of hospitals with 50 or more beds with a palliative care team increased from 658 to 1,831, a 178% increase, 178% increase between 2000 and 2016. This is good news. Of course, as you likely know, legalized assisted suicide has grown even as this availability of palliative care has grown. It's now legal in 10 states and the District of Columbia. Legislation, of course, legalizing assisted suicide has been introduced in other states. And here in Illinois, we had expected it would be introduced this year. It has not been yet, but there's still time. We're having a veto session in October, and we think it may be introduced there, perhaps as an amendment to a bill. And if not, almost certainly in the 2024 legislative session. If you followed the situation in Canada, you've seen the worst of the worst when it comes to what these proponents now call medical aid in dying, or MAID. Alexander Rankin's article in the winter 2023 issue of The New Atlantis is probably still the definitive coverage on the situation with our neighbors to the north. There, MAID includes options for both assisted suicide and active direct euthanasia. And Rankin reports that in Canada, virtually all such deaths, over 99%, are euthanasia. Now, of course, there are significant differences between Canada and the United States. Foremost in the context of this is that they have a nationalized healthcare system. Rankin reports that it is a system that does encourage the vulnerable to seek medical death. He continues, a number of recent news articles have reported on Canadians who, driven by poverty and lack of access to adequate healthcare, housing, and social services, have turned to the country's euthanasia system. In multiple cases, veterans requesting help from Veterans Affairs of Canada, at least one asked for PTSD treatment, another for a ramp for a wheelchair, were asked instead by caseworkers, would you like to apply for euthanasia? The result is that in 2021, 10,064 people were reported to have died under Canada's MAID system. 10,064. California is a very useful point of comparison. Both Canada and California legalized assisted suicide in 2016. The population is similar, about 40 million, roughly. The Canadians are just a little more spread out. In 2021 in California, the number of people who used assisted suicide was 486. In Canada, 10,064. Canada arguably is also further down the road of being a post-Christian nation. Certainly, there are complex sets of issues at work both there and here. But the Christian stake in bioethics, anyone? I encourage you to set aside some time and read Rankin's article. It's entitled No Other Options, and I'll post a link to it in the Whova app. I also think of direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription pharmaceuticals, which is legal only in the United States and in New Zealand, and ways in which that affects our healthcare system. Of course, our number one vote-getter was CRISPR. In his introduction to the book, The Codebreaker, which is about the discoverers of CRISPR, or inventors, discoverers, I'm not sure, Walter Isaacson writes, "Figuring out if and when to edit our genes will be one of the most consequential questions of the 21st century." And indeed, the subtitle of the book includes Gene Editing and the Future of the Human Race. Already, we're seeing wonderful results from work with CRISPR. Victoria Gray, 37 years old, of Forest, Mississippi, was the first person with sickle cell disease to receive a CRISPR-based treatment. Today, all of her symptoms are gone. Before she got the treatment, the deformed sickle-shaped red blood cells caused by this genetic disorder would regularly incapacitate her with intense and unpredictable attacks of pain. Those crises would send her rushing to the hospital for pain medication and blood transfusion. She could barely get out of bed many days. When she became a mom, she found it impossible to care for her four children. She couldn't finish school. She could not keep a job. But now, she works full-time at Walmart as a cashier. She keeps up with her teenagers. She said, "It's a huge difference, night and day. I feel like I got a second chance." I mentioned earlier the birth of gene-edited babies in China in 2018, the work of He Jiankui, who served 3 years in prison for it. In March of this year, the third International Summit on Human Genome Editing took place. At the conclusion of the meeting, the summit's organizing committee put out its closing statement. They said heritable human genome editing, editing embryos that are then implanted to establish a pregnancy, which can pass on their edited DNA, remains unacceptable at this time. Public discussions and policy debates continue and are important for resolving whether this technology should be used. How long will this moratorium hold? For what reasons will it be overturned? And in the meantime, how many embryos will be modified but not transferred to a womb? We're in the midst of the rise to prominence in a whole new way and to a whole new degree of issues surrounding sex and gender. Among the most incendiary of topics currently are the use of puberty blockers and surgical alterations for minors. Outside the US, increasing caution seems to be the trend. The UK's National Health Service recently announced, for example, that puberty blockers will only be prescribed to children attending gender identity services as part of clinical research. And Sweden and Finland have similar limitations. Beyond this and closer to home, I've been asked many times by many folks how churches might respond to members of their youth group who announce that they're trans. Or what do we do when a visitor arrives or a member announces that he or she is a trans person? What does Christian love look like? What does Christian hospitality look like in these situations? How does the church respond? Well, begin with prayer. Seek wisdom. But before these things begin, we need to teach in our churches on the goodness of our embodiment, even in the midst of the frailties of human life in the aftermath of the fall. Offer congregants a robust, biblically based, and theologically thick account of the human person. And there are practical steps as well, designating, if possible, a bathroom as single occupant. I recommend very highly, and I'll put links to this as well in the Whova app, I recommend very highly talks given a few months ago in this very room as part of the 2023 EFCA Theology Conference, one by our friend Loris Colgin, who spoke last year at this conference, and by Greg Allison from Southern Seminary. Both talks were on a theology of the human body and human sexuality, and both are available in full through the EFCA's YouTube channel. And as I said, I'll post links. These are careful, thoughtful, and wise presentations. Let me get a sip before we go on to this. I would be remiss, I think, in talking about where we are today if I did not also touch on one other controversial topic. The COVID pandemic has left some deep rifts, perhaps not least among Christians. Some feel that the restrictions, mask requirements, and vaccine mandates were too severe, and that churches and businesses were wrong to follow them. Others feel that the restrictions, requirements, and mandates were somewhere between perfectly fine and not quite strong enough. And of course, many fall in between. But churches lost members over these things. Friendships were ruptured, family even divided. And people lost jobs, left careers over these restrictions, requirements, and mandates. How can we avoid this kind of fracturing in the future? How might we heal these deep rifts that exist today? Artificial intelligence has come to increased prominence over the past few months thanks to the introduction of large language models such as OpenAI's ChatGPT, Google's Bard, and text-to-image and text-to-video models like DALL-E, Stable Diffusion, and Adobe's Firefly. Providing a definition of artificial intelligence is something of an academic industry all its own. Consider but one example. In What Do You Mean by AI?, Temple University's Pei Wang looks at five ways of defining AI in terms of its structure, its behavior, its capabilities, its function, or its rooting principle. And AI exists along something of a continuum, from algorithms of various complexities to the yet still pursued, hoped for by some, feared by others, artificial general intelligence, or AGI. One area we already see AI playing a role is in the realm of drug discovery. Machine programming can mix and match various chemical elements in an attempt to find new medicines. Researchers at a North Carolina pharmaceutical company ran an experiment with one such AI and made a tiny coding change that caused it to generate 40,000 deadly molecules. And indeed, many worry about the existential threat from artificial intelligence. But there are other concerns that are already evident. The generation and amplification of misinformation, bias in training and in data outputs, issues of privacy that are related to the amounts of data that are needed for training. Within the last couple of weeks, the Wall Street Journal ran an article entitled, "When AI Overrules the Nurses Who Are Caring for You," from the article. In a survey of 1,042 registered nurses published this month by National Nurses United, 24% of respondents said they had been prompted by a clinical algorithm to make choices that they believed were not in the best interest of patients based on their clinical judgment and their scope of practice. Of those, 17% said they were permitted to override the decision. 31% were not allowed to override the decision. And 34% said they needed a doctor or supervisor's permission to go against the recommendation of the artificial intelligence. Recent articles in the New England Journal include Artificial Intelligence and Machine Learning in Clinical Medicine 2023, The Benefits, Limits, and Risks of GPT-4 as an AI chatbot for medicine. These, and it was a whole series of articles, are a lead up to the launch of a new journal in the New England portfolio, an online monthly journal on AI, which is to identify and evaluate state-of-the-art applications of artificial intelligence to clinical medicine. In addition to original research, NEJM AI will provide reviews, policy perspectives, and accessible educational materials targeted at practicing physicians and clinical leaders interested in applying AI, computer scientists seeking to translate algorithmic advances to clinical practice, and policymakers and regulators. And the inaugural issue is set to be published in August of this year. Just this month, the Southern Baptist Convention passed a resolution on AI and emerging technologies. According to Baptist Press, in what is believed to be the first denominational statement on the ethics of artificial intelligence, Southern Baptists acknowledged the powerful potential of AI and other emerging technologies, and they expressed a desire, quote, to engage them from a place of eschatological hope rather than uncritical embrace or fearful rejection. And it goes on from there. The Christian stake in bioethics. Among other current issues in bioethics, CBHD Academy member Christina Ritchie has focused her work on the environmental impact of healthcare, thinking about the energy required to run hospitals, the carbon footprint of the pharmaceutical industry, and more. Three parent embryos, which I mentioned a minute ago, are opening the door to all kinds of genetic manipulations, and they sit alongside the work of creating life in the lab and holding it there longer. Scientists recently have kept primate embryos in a lab for 25 days post-fertilization, achieving key developmental landmarks that have never before been observed in culture, including the start of organ development. There is, as I mentioned, a strong push to extend the 14-day rule on how long human embryos can be kept alive in the lab. And with results like this from primates, synthetic human embryos were recently created in a project between Caltech and Cambridge, yet another development with the human embryo. Issues of conscience also continue. This week, it was announced that the federal government has declined to appeal a ruling in the case of Sisters of Mercy versus Bessarea that protects the religious freedom of physicians to refuse to perform gender transitions. This is something of a surprise, even if a welcome surprise. And this is the second time that this same mandate has been in court over its conflict with the protection of religious freedom and the protection of conscience. And gratefully, this is the second time it's been blocked. But how long will this last? What other challenges to conscience and religious freedom will emerge? Time does not allow mention, certainly, of all the issues we might face today, but I've tried to mention several that seem significant to me, and perhaps some that are less closely followed than they might be. So now, let us look ahead. In some ways, it's difficult to disentangle fully the bioethics issues of today and tomorrow. Perhaps some of the pressing issues we deal with now will be solved or will fade away. But it seems to me much more likely that we'll continue dealing, at least in some measure, with many of the same things that we're dealing with today, along with new issues. Wired magazine last month presented a list of developments we should expect to see soon in hospitals. They include fully autonomous surgical robots, smart toilets that monitor and detect disease, and don't you think they're only going to sell those to hospitals? 3D printed organs, ambient documentation, which is AI simply listening in the room during an exam, then summarizing and at least initiating the charting, and knives that smell tumors. On Wednesday, as I was sort of finishing up work on this, I received an email about the upcoming Prime Day deals. We all look forward to Prime Day. This year, one of the Prime Day deals is 25% off my first year of membership in One Medical, their Amazon's medical program. It offers 24/7 virtual visits, in-person appointments in select areas, and of course, a tight integration with Amazon Pharmacy. What does the future of healthcare look like with a company like Amazon getting involved now? That would give Amazon a ton of information about me. Of course, not that they don't already know a lot about me. Guy buys a lot of hats, a lot of sunscreen, long sleeve shirts. I wonder what a dermatologist has to say. It's interesting, too, that in the email, Amazon used the language of provider, as in compassionate providers who take time to listen. Send and receive secure messages with a provider. This stands in contrast to the physician as a professional, as CMDA's Jeff Barrows addressed here at last year's conference. And this is another likely change as we move forward, or continued change. The continued transition from the physician, the nurse, the physician assistant, as a covenantal professional, to the physician as a transactional provider. Much like a contractor who comes in to redo your kitchen. What color do you want? How big do you want? How small do you want? Contracts limit, covenants expand. Notions around personhood are likely to change or expand. We're already seeing the emergence of the somewhat novel concept of the non-human person. Artificial intelligence, perhaps some other animal species, might fit into the category of non-human person. And robots and androids raise interesting questions about things like autonomy and responsibility. In America, almost all of our laws at the local, state, and federal levels share the assumption that all decisions are made by human beings. What does free will look like for a robot or an android? Who is responsible for the things that robots do? Can or should robots be punished for wrongdoing or lawbreaking? Is it possible to murder a robot or an AI? That one we're going to find out. I guarantee somebody's going to murder a robot. Well, kill it. Is it murder? That's the question. Already, the concept of personhood and the idea of rights are beginning to expand. There was a case in New York a few years ago seeking to establish the personhood of an elephant in order to spring it from a zoo. That failed. An Argentinian court in 2014 ruled that an orangutan is a non-human person. How might these concepts be extended to robots or artificial intelligences or androids? How might human-machine hybrid cyborgs be viewed? What about concepts like human dignity? Is there such a thing as e-person dignity, AI person dignity? New technologies have far-reaching and long-lasting effects. Consider this quote from an article on Anabaptist technology. You heard that right. Anabaptist technology. As Neil Postman argues, it's not possible to contain the effects of technology to a limited sphere of human activity. One significant change generates total change. One significant change generates total change. And then he gives a string of examples to illustrate the point. If you remove caterpillars from a habitat, you're not left with the same environment minus caterpillars. You have a new environment, and you have reconstituted the conditions of survival. The same is true if you add caterpillars to an environment that doesn't have them. Likewise, in 1500, 50 years after the printing press was invented, we did not have old Europe plus the printing press. We had a different Europe. And the same was true after the invention of the automobile, the radio, the television, and every other major technology. This is both inevitable and uncertain. Consider what it would mean to substitute various bioethical issues into this framework. 50 years after assisted suicide was legalized, we didn't have the same world plus assisted suicide. We had a different world. Perhaps something tangentially related, but closer to us in our pockets and purses, 16 years after the iPhone was introduced, what about 7 years after medical aid in dying was legalized in Canada? Maybe I overstate. Maybe it's something to think about. And then doubtless, there will be something else that we're not expecting, or something that a few anticipate, but that emerges quickly, or on a broad scale, or in some way that was difficult to predict, and that is difficult to deal with. Cough, cough, COVID. So to sum up till now, these issues of tomorrow, am I a guess, and it's just a guess, the most significant issues will be the continued spread of assisted suicide and increasing push towards euthanasia. Gene editing, issues arising out of artificial intelligence, issues of conscience that arise in the above, and something else I'm not fully aware of, because it's not fully on very many people's radar at all. And this isn't to push aside other issues. These other issues are going to be with us as well. But I think in terms of the sort of big things that we're going to face over the next 10, 15, 30 years, that's kind of where we are. In some ways, some of these things I think are symptoms, maybe even symptoms of symptoms. There are deeper issues at work. To return for a moment to Nigel Cameron's thoughts from that very first conference, he writes that the practice of medicine has historically represented the interlocking of Christian and Hippocratic values. Alongside the rise of bioethics, he saw, back in 1994, the collapse of Judeo-Christian anthropology. He writes, "We should anticipate a radical divergence of perspectives between those who would maintain the Judeo-Christian anthropology and those whose very starting point is its repudiation. Indeed, insofar as the humane medical tradition was the epitome of that anthropology, the humane medical tradition was the epitome of the Judeo-Christian anthropology. Insofar as that is true, a case could be made for seeing bioethics as the cockpit of the struggle with post-Christian concepts of our nature, the testbed for new understandings of what it means to be human as we come to the twilight of the Christian era." Cameron argues that we had been caught up prior to 1994 in ad hoc assessments of emerging technologies like in vitro and surrogacy because we failed to articulate a clear, biblically grounded anthropology of the human person. Thus, he writes, "We are engaging piecemeal in the reconstruction of human nature for the purposes of the post-Christian culture." And what corrective does he offer? "Our engagement in these many questions of bioethics must find its grounding in the distinctives of the Judeo-Christian anthropology. He insists we must recover a clear biblical and historical conviction of the nature of Christian medicine and its stake in the fate of public Hippocratic tradition. And secondly, we must build institutions, and this will include nurturing communities of dissident medicine." Now, the notion of communities of dissident medicine may bring to mind concepts like Rod Dreher's Benedict option and some of the various other options that it has spawned. In brief, what Dreher means is that as Western culture continues to move into a post-Christian era, local forms of community, of Christian community, will become even more important for supporting and sustaining members of the Christian tradition. Writing to Christians, he asserts that much of Christianity today is captured by moralistic therapeutic deism, which in brief is the view that God exists, God wants us to be happy, God wants us to be nice to one another, and his primary work is to come in and solve problems and otherwise just leave us alone. So people go to church to be entertained, and to see and to hang out with their friends, if much as, if not more than, to worship. In a way that combines several of the threads I've discussed here, Dreher writes, technology then becomes a kind of theology. It's a protean theology, though, because the God, little g, God to whom it bears witness, is the ever-changing self that is seeking liberation from all limits and all unchosen obligations. Autonomy, individualism, atomization, fragmentation. In response, Dreher advocates local, face-to-face communities of Christian who share as much of their lives as they can. That's why we're so excited to be able to come back and meet here in person, face-to-face, local Christian community. The church community is not merely the people one worships with on Sunday. They're the people one lives with, one serves with, and one nurtures as if they were family members. As Cameron said, the work of Christians who are concerned about the issues of bioethics should be first marked by an energetic exploration of both the biblical theological distinctives which ground our medical anthropology and the public tradition of Christian Hippocratism, which has carried those concerns down through the lifetime of our civilization, the lifetime of our civilization. And how might this be affected by generational change? The youngest of the baby boomers turns 60 next year, which means the oldest of Gen X turns 60 in 2025. The center's founders were of the silent generation and the baby boom generation. Michael and I are of Generation X. Anna and Brian are millennials. The shift is already underway. I'm hearing really good things about Gene Twenge's new book, Generations, but I haven't had a chance to read it in full. But she does report, millennials are among the least religious generation of younger adults in American history, at least as far back as we have statistics, and at least until Gen Z probably eclipses them. The Christian stake in bioethics. How do we respond? This is exactly what we're going to explore in next year's conference. Our working title for now is The Future of Health, faith, ethics, and our medtech world. And we've chosen each of these words carefully. The future, obvious. Health, what is it even going to mean to be healthy in the future? What are we going to mean by that? Faith, of course. Ethics, what is it that we do in response to our faith and in response to what we now consider to be health? And our increasingly medically sophisticated, technologically awe-inspiring world. The future of health, faith, ethics, and our med tech world. Already confirmed speakers include Dr. Keith Plummer, Dean and Professor of Theology at the School of Divinity at Cairn University outside Pennsylvania. He's going to present the second annual Virtue Ethics Lecture. He does a lot of work around technology and virtue and apologetics and technology, in addition to systematic theology and pastoral counseling. He recently published an essay in the 2023 book, The Digital Public Square, Christian Ethics in a Technological Society. Jason Thacker, he's now assistant professor of philosophy and ethics at Boyce College in Louisville, Kentucky, which is on the campus of Southern Seminary. He's also a research fellow in Christian ethics and the director of research of the Research Institute at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is a bit of a mouthful. And he's the editor of the volume, The Digital Public Square, Christian Ethics and Technological Society. He's just begun work on a project on generative artificial intelligence, like ChatGPT, and so we're asking him to come and speak on generative artificial intelligence and bioethics. Our own Anna Valamo, a research scholar here at CBHD, and Maretu Guta of Biola and Azusa Pacific, they are together going to address idolatry of technology, which grows out of an article that they're co-writing, and it's going to be a book. They've been talking about it. It's going to be a book. We all know. And then our own Michael Sleesman, well known to this audience, is going to close us out next year. Talking about reframing the future of health, summarizing the conference, and then sending us out on our way. Things are moving quickly in this field, as you know, and so we're inviting additional addresses. I have an invitation out now I'm waiting to hear back on theological anthropology, but I'm very excited about the person who I've invited for that. Something on theology of technology, and of course, technology in the clinical context, technology in the context of medical education. These are very important. To the ways in which it's going to shape the future of what it means to be healthy, the future of what it means to care well for one another in the healthcare setting. And then I'm looking forward to something on far future emerging technologies. Astroethics, perhaps? Now, the dates for next year's conference shift just slightly. Next year's a leap year, and so it will be later in June, June 27 to 29. So I hope that you will plan right now to join us then. Of course, that's a year away, and the issues of today and tomorrow loom now. And so let us look, if only briefly, at maybe an introductory or a very basic theological anthropology. Where better to begin than in the book of Genesis? God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply." We are created. We are created in the image of God. We are created male and female. We are created and blessed. We are created and given purpose. As Dr. Kilner reminds us in his Dignity and Destiny, which has been mentioned several times, and I remember the first time I was reading it, I was just struck at the amount of research that went into that book and how, as someone administering a center, I will never have that kind of time. But it is really a giant amount of research that he has brought together in that book, and so I do highly recommend it to you. But as Dr. Kilner reminds us, Jesus Christ is the image of God, and we human beings are created in or after or according to that image. Emphasizing a similar point, Christopher West writes, Everything in the Christian faith hinges on the incarnation, on the Word made flesh. Ours is an enfleshed religion, and we must be careful not to unflesh it. We are placed, bodily placed, in community, actually in many communities, in communities of communities. Nancy Piercy writes, "Each of us begins life as a dependent, helpless baby, born into a pre-existing family, clan, church, town, nation. We grow into mature adults only because other people, especially our parents, but many others, commit to us sacrificially, to love us, to teach us, to care for us." One upshot for bioethics, as Andy Crouch writes, is whenever policy is made or preferences are shaped by the dream of escaping the vulnerabilities, the givenness, and the interdependence of human life, our bodies will be despised, and those who treat embodied persons with reverence will be mocked. So we must both communicate and rely on a robust, biblically based, theologically precise concept of the human person that clarifies and affirms the givenness, the vulnerabilities, and the interdependence of embodied human life. Now, notably, as Dr. Ray was mentioning before, this doesn't always have to be done in biblical or theological terms. Take, for example, Carter Sneed's What It Means to Be Human as a case in point. As you probably know, in that volume, he develops a sound picture of, as the title indicates, what it means to be human, namely embodied, placed in community, interdependent. And he spells out the ways in which these are implicated in the realm of bioethics. Even more, he illuminates ways in which we might better understand ourselves and our fellow human beings, which leads us to caring well for others and, importantly, so importantly, allowing ourselves to be well cared for. He does this by developing what he terms the virtues of acknowledged dependence, or I like even better when he calls them the virtues of embodied life. They are just generosity. This is acting in the aid of another merely on the grounds of their need. It's just because it's fitting to return that which we've received. And it's generous because it's offered in genuine regard for the needs of the other. Hospitality, rendering aid to a stranger simply because he or she is a stranger, and doing so ungrudgingly and without condition. Merciful compassion, taking on the suffering of another as your own suffering. And this might lead to caring, to offering caring or assistance to them, but it may mean simply accompanying them through their suffering. Gratitude, the fitting recognition and response to the care of others, past, present, and future. Humility, recognition that our life and our talents are not our own making. Openness to the unbidden, a disposition of welcoming and hospitality towards others in all their uniqueness, particularity, and peculiarity. A toleration of imperfection and indifference. Solidarity, extending our field of concern to encompass those beyond our immediate circle. Dignity, the recognition of the intrinsic equal worth of all human beings who are alike in vulnerability, in neediness, and who are all alike in being subject to natural limits. All human beings stand in a vast network of giving and receiving that is necessary for human flourishing. All human beings are created and embodied, unrepeatable, precious, and fundamentally equal. And finally, truthfulness. It's necessary to be honest with and about ourselves and to ourselves about our nature as embodied and thus interdependent beings. These are the virtues of embodied life. Finally, as created, embodied, dependent, rational creatures, the Christian stake in bioethics is exactly this. Bioethics addresses questions of how we treat human beings in the specific context of the frailties of human life in the aftermath of the fall. And so, May we go forth from here, keeping in the forefront of our minds that the context for medicine is this: the alleviation of the bitter consequences of the fall, staying the hand of death for a season, and anticipating, and as Dr. Jaggard pointed out this morning, bearing witness to the final resurrection of the body. Thank you.
That was my plenary address, Bioethics Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, which closed out this year's 30th annual conference. Remember to become a member of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity today in order to gain access to content from the center that simply can't be found anywhere else. And then watch your email inbox next week for an announcement about the next book discussion group. You don't want to miss this. You've been listening to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, copyright 2023, all rights reserved. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a Christian bioethics research center at Trinity International University, exploring the nexus of biomedicine, biotechnology, and our common humanity. Our website, cbhd.org, has a wealth of materials on a wide range of bioethical issues. For more information about the center and to support the work of the center and projects like this podcast, please visit our website, cbhd.org. My name is Matthew Epinette, and I'm the executive director of the center. Thank you for listening to the Bioethics Podcast.